Yeah. King, please search out that deer who is engaged in eating grass in a very nice flower garden along with his wife. That deer is very much attached to his business and he's enjoying the sweet singing of the bumblebees in his garden. Just try to understand his position. He's unaware that before him is a tiger who is accustomed to living at the cost of another's flesh. Behind the deer is a hunter who is threatening to pierce him with sharp arrows. Thus the deer's life. Death is imminent. For a part, here's an allegory in which the king is advised to find a deer that is always in a dangerous position or a threat from all sides. The deer simply eats grass in a nice flower garden, unaware of the danger all around him. All living entities, especially human beings, think themselves very happy in the midst of families. As if living in a flower garden and hearing the sweet humming of bumblebees, every one is centered around his wife, who is the beauty of family life. Bumblebees' humming may be compared to the talk of children, the human being. And just like the deer enjoys his family without knowing that before him is the factor of time, which is represented by the tiger. The fruit of activities of the living entity simply create another dangerous position and oblige him to accept different types of bodies. For a deer to run after a mirage of water in the desert is not unusual. The deer is always very fond of sex. The conclusion is that one who lives like a deer will be killed in due course of time. Native literature is therefore advised that we should understand our constant position and take devotional service before death comes. According to Srimad Bhagavatam, Lavasatrulamamidam Bahu, Sambhavante, Manusham Artadam, Anityam, Abhiha, Nira, Purnam Yateta, Napatet, Anuvrittiya, Van, Nishayasaya, Vishaya, Kalu, Sarvatasya. At many births, we have attained this human form, therefore, before death comes, we should engage ourselves in the transcendental loving service of the Lord as fulfillment of human life. Text 54. My dear king, woman who is very attractive in the beginning but in the end very disturbing, exactly like the flower, which is attractive in the beginning and detestable at the end. With woman, the living entity is entangled with lusty desires and enjoys sex just as one enjoys the aroma of the flower. He thus enjoys a life of sense gratification from his tongue to his genitals. In this way, the living entity considers himself very happy in family life. United with his wife, he always remains absorbed in such thoughts. He feels great pleasure in hearing the talks of his wife and children, which are like the sweet humming of bumblebees that collect honey from flower to flower. He forgets that before him is time, which is taking away his lifespan with the passing of day and night. He does not see the gradual diminishing of his life, nor does he care about the superintendent of death who is trying to kill him from behind. Let's try to understand this. You are in a precarious position under threat from all sides. Therefore, materialistic life means forgetting one's constitutional position as eternal servant of Krishna, and this forgetfulness is especially enhanced in the Grihastha Ashram. In the Grihastha Ashram, a young man accepts a young wife who is very beautiful in the beginning and in due course of time, after giving birth to many children and becomes older and older, she demands many things from the husband to maintain the entire family. At such a time, the wife becomes detestable to the very man who accepted her in her younger days. One becomes attached to the Grihastha Ashram for 2 reasons only. The wife cooks palatable dishes for the satisfaction of her husband's tongue and gives him sexual pleasure. At night, a person attached to the Grihastha Ashram is always thinking of these 2 things, palatable food and sex enjoyment. The talks of the wife, which are enjoyed as a family recreation, the talks of the children, both attract the living entity. He thus forgets that he has to die someday and has to prepare for the next life if he wants to be put into a congenial body. The deer in the garden, flower garden, is an allegory used by the great sage Narada to point out to the king that the king himself is similarly entrapped by such surroundings. Actually, everyone is engaged, surrounded by such family life which misleads one. Living entity thus forgets that he has to return home back to Godhead. He simply becomes entangled in family life. Prahlad Maharaj has therefore hinted, Hipatma Patam Agriham Andakupam Avanam Gato Yad Parim Asraeta. Family life is considered a blind well into which a person falls and dies without help. Prahlad Maharaja recommends that while one's senses are there and one is strong enough, he should abandon the Grihastha Ashram and take shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, according to the course of Vrindavan. According to Vedic civilization, one has to give up family life at a certain age, the age of 50, take vanaprastha and eventually remain alone as a sannyasi. That is the prescribed method of Vedic civilization known as Varnashram Dharma. And one takes sannyas after enjoying family life, he pleases the Supreme Lord Krishna. One has to understand one's position in family or worldly life. That is called intelligence. One should not remain always trapped in family life and satisfied on the genitals and association with the wife. In such a way, one simply spoils his life. According to Vedic civilization, it is imperative to give up family at a certain stage by force if necessary. Unfortunately, so far followers of Vedic life do not give up their family even at the end of life unless they are forced by death. There should be a thorough overhauling of the social system and society should revert to the Vedic principles, that is, the 4 Varnas and the Ashrams. My dear king, please search out that deer who is engaged in eating grass in a very nice flower garden along with his wife. The deer is very much attached to his business as he is enjoying the sweet singing of the bumblebees in his garden. Let's try to understand his position. He is unaware that before it was a tiger, which is accustomed to living in the cosmos and of his flesh. Behind the deer is a hunter who is threatened to pierce sharp arrows. Thus, the deer's death is imminent. My dear king, a woman who is very attractive in the beginning but in the end very disturbing, exactly like the flower, which is attractive in the beginning and detestable in the end. With woman, the living entity is entangled with lust desires, enjoys sex just as one enjoys the aroma of the flower. He thus enjoys a life of sense gratification from his tongue to his genitals, and in this way, the living entity considers himself very happy in family life. United with his wife, he always remains absorbed in such thoughts. He feels great pleasure in hearing the talks of his wife and children, which are like the sweet honey of bumblebees that collect honey from wild flower. He forgets that before him is time, which is taking one's lifespan with the passing of day and night. He does not see the gradual diminishing of his life, nor does he care about the superintendent of death who is trying to kill him from behind. Just try to understand this. You are in a precarious position, threatened from all sides. So, here we have the other analogy, and that is a deer in a garden absorbed in the flowers and with the bees humming around. And he's unaware that there's a tiger in front of him ready to eat him out, and behind there's a hunter with his arrows ready to pierce him with his arrows. So this particularly refers to a person in the material world who was absorbed in family life. Here it mentions that the deer is there, but he's not alone. He's with his wife. That is represented here by the word titva, a pair. They're together. He's together with his wife, and absorbed in the pleasures of that garden, flower garden. So what are the pleasures of the flower garden? One, of course, the female deer is there. The other, of course, is the nice flowers are there to look at and to smell. And he hears the nice humming of the bees. So in this way, all the different senses get certain pleasure in this situation. And what is the situation? The situation is the material world in which people try to enjoy. And of course, in the material world, the normal position is that of family life. So therefore we have the deer and the female deer together. And they have a house, and they have nice surroundings, and they have children, etc. And in this way they satisfy their senses. They have 10 senses, and each of the senses gets some sort of satisfaction from this situation. So this, of course, is one sense, material life. And Varnashram system takes care of that. So Grihastha Ashram means that people get their livelihood and they're able to be happy with the family. That is Varnashram system. So unfortunately, that is also a problem. And that is why Lord Chaitanya rejects the Varnashram system, because it makes you too comfortable. You get stuck in your varna and your ashrama, and you don't want to move out of it. And in the varna ashram system, most people are grihasthas. 99% are grihasthas almost. You know, some people are brahmacharis for a short time, then they become grihasthas also. So even the Brahmins are mainly grihasthas. And there are very, very few sannyasis and very, very few vanaprasthas. So the majority of the society is grihasthas. And in fact, the majority of varnas are sudras. And sudras don't take any ashram except grihastha. They don't become brahmacharis, they don't become vanaprasthas, they don't become sannyasis. So automatically, most of the society is made up of grihasthas, majority. And therefore, the majority is going to enjoy. So this is one problem with varnashram. The majority are going to be enjoyers. And that's a system provides you with the enjoyment. And why? You can be comfortable in this situation. Of course, you have to follow certain rules and you have to be pious, etc. You have to control your senses. So that is the benefit. It provides for that enjoyment with minimization of sin. And therefore, future life is considered better rather than worse. So that is the advantage over haphazard enjoyment and family life in a non-varnashramic system. But the limitation is that one gets too attached to that particular situation as a grihastha. So that is condemned here. Of course, this could also be a situation, it's not even a grihastha, it's just family life in general, not even in the varnashram system. But even in the varnashram system, the family life is also condemned here, because one will tend to get too attracted. Of course, there are safeguards. One safeguard is that at least the upper classes, the Vaishyas and Kshatriyas and the Brahmanas, should get some spiritual education by learning the Vedas, etc., as children. that way, and as the brahmacharis, they do austerities. So then when the vihastas, they're not overly attached. That is the prescription. Unfortunately, that system no longer exists, and very few people take brahmachari life. Even 500 years ago, not that many people became brahmacharis. We see in Lord Chaitanya's movement, there's one brahmachari. You don't hear about any other brahmacharis. Huh? They didn't learn the Vedas so much, even though they took Upanayana and they didn't go and learn Vedas. So, even 500 years ago, not much was intact with that system. And the other safeguard, of course, is that after the Grahastha Ashram, the upper caste, again, the Vaishyas and the Kshatriyas and the Brahmanas, should go to Vanaprastha Ashram, which means they go to the forest and build a little hut there and wander around in the forest and eat the roots and fruits and sleep on the ground. And very rare people do that also, because that is so austere that even yogis don't do that much anymore. So that system also not there very much. So that was the system, and then from there they go to sannyas, and sannyas, only Brahmins are qualified for that, and Brahmins are the, let's say, 2% of the society, and then those who take sannyas are maybe 0.1% or whatever. So very few sannyasis are around also. So the safeguards are there in terms of brahmachari and vanaprastha life for the upper classes, nothing for the sudras. Still, we see that these things get neglected over time, and therefore as Kali Yuga progresses, less brahmacharya life and less vanaprastha life, and only grihastha life is there. It's the only ashram present after a while. So the whole varnashram system more or less gets, you know, meaningless. So of course the varnas also get upset, and not much of varna left also. Therefore the grihastha ashram is rather precarious in the modern world. And even in the ancient world, even the precautions were there with vanaprastha life and brahmachari life maybe 1,000 years ago or before that. Still, dangers are there, and we see the danger represented by the king, Prashnabari. He was too involved in grihastha life, and he couldn't see spiritual life at all. He wasn't aware of it. He was simply involved in karmakanda or material enjoyment. So therefore, even at that time of Prashnabari, who was a great king also, he was also bewildered by the situation of family life. So therefore, even though the Varnashram system is glorified, at the same time it is dangerous in one sense, because everyone becomes a grihastha, and the grihastha life also, though there are some precautions, still liability is one becomes overcome by attachment. And that is represented here. So, the deer is with his wife in the forest, in the garden, enjoying the flowers and the humming of the bees, etc. And because his grihastha life is a failure in one sense, therefore he fails to realize the tiger is there, the hunter is there. So, it's not a very pleasant situation that time is making the person older, and eventually the person has to die. But because of the enjoyment, one forgets. So that is the basic analogy given here. That, even in the Varnashram system, as a grihastha, still there is a problem in that one tends to forget that the material body is temporary. And therefore, one has to wake up from this position somehow or other. So Narada Muni does this through this analogy of the deer in the forest, and he's in a very dangerous position to make the king realize that in spite of his feeling of happiness, nevertheless he has to give all this up eventually. He has to die in the material body, etc. And this, of course, is maybe we can say a summary of the other analogy of Paranjana in a city. He was enjoying in a city, and then he had to give up the city eventually. He got burned down and he had to leave the city. So a similar type of analogy, condensed in this form of two animals living in a garden. So the message is the same, that one cannot be attached. So the solution is ultimately that one has to awaken somehow to spiritual life. The Varnashram system is not enough. because we see here it's criticized as being this is a dangerous position of a person in the varnashram system, especially if it's not intact. It will not function properly. So the solution as given by Narada Muni was that one has to take to the process of bhakti yoga and become enlightened spiritually. Varnashram system is not a spiritual system, it's a material system to keep you happy in the material world. And maybe you can go to Brahmaloka eventually. So it doesn't really ultimately make you spiritual. It is indirectly spiritual, yes, because it's supplied by the Lord, and eventually you're supposed to go beyond that to Dhyana, Sangha Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. So, okay, in that sense, okay. But in itself, no. It simply elevates you in the material world. So, of course, the ideal situation in this elevation is one eventually becomes detached and becomes a vanaprastha and then maybe a sannyasi. But that takes many, many lifetimes to get to that position. And one becomes a sannyasi, then one is detached from material life. One is renounced completely. So that is the positive aspect of varnashram. But as we see, most of the people aren't qualified because they're sudras, so they can't even take sannyas. So they'll never get to that position in this body, obviously. It'll take them many, many lifetimes to get up to the position of being a Brahmin, and then as a Brahmin, then they have to eventually take sannyas. But we see, even in the modern world, how many Brahmins take sannyas? Maybe 1 out of 10 million, or something like that. In South India, how many Sri Vaishnavas take sannyas? Maybe 10. How many Sri Vaishnavas are there in South India? Some million, few million, at least. And maybe 10 are there. So it's not a very big percent. Less than 1%. 0.1% maybe. That's the modern world. That, of course, is one sampradaya. Shankara sampradaya, not less. Maybe 5 in the whole Shankara, from the Shankara, so 5 sannyasis. So very, very few. Therefore, in Kali Yuga, the system really doesn't work for everybody. The system that does work, of course, is bhakti. The majority of the people can do bhakti. They cannot renounce. They cannot become detached. They're not qualified for that. But the majority of the people can do the bhakti. People are born as sudras, so they can't renounce anything all their lifetime. But those who take the bhakti, they can progress. So this is direct spiritual life, direct form of spiritual life. Others, indirect. So that system takes a long time for a person to develop it. And bhakti is direct, and the system is quick. So that is why Krishna recommends that in chapter 12 of Bhagavad Gita. This system is a quick system, and it is not so difficult as the other system. Therefore, bhakti is recommended. So that is ultimately the recommendation here in our book also, that one has to take to the process of bhakti. So, of course, we see that the rule is there, that is actually even quoted by Lord Chaitanya, of course, in relation to something else. In a conversation with John Kazi, he mentions that certain things are prevented, including the horse sacrifice and cow sacrifices. We see that all sampradayas are there. Even the Mayavadis have sannyas, what to speak of the Vaishnavas. And we have sannyasis in the Madhva Sampradaya and in the Sri Sampradaya as well, and in the Mayavada Sampradaya as well. Pallavas, I don't think, have any sannyasis, most are grihasthas. And Nirmarka, I don't know about that at all. Maybe there are a few or something. But anyway, we see it is still current. So, why? Why would they take sannyas if it is forbidden in Kali Yuga? Of course, one is obvious forbidden to me. It is not practical for most of the people. And as I said already, anyway, most of the people don't take sannyas, but even less than take sannyas in Kali Yuga. The other, of course, is explanation given is, I think by Bhakti Sanasar Swati Thakur, is that The type of sannyas that is forbidden is where one completely gives up all activities. That type of sannyas is prohibited. In other words, one becomes a complete vairagi and whatever, and does great austerities. Whereas the sannyasi who engages himself in the service of the Lord, that is not forbidden. So that's his explanation of that.
In terms of emotion, can we compare that
sannyasis
are more devoted than the sannyasis are more
devoted?
Does
they are?
Can you see that
sannyasis
devotees are more
pure or behaving? May or may not be. Obviously, in Lord Chaitanya Sampradaya, for many, many generations, there weren't any sannyasis. We can't say nobody was pure because of that. Maybe they weren't, but anyway, we can't say simply on that basis. So there weren't any sannyasis, and the Bhakti Siddhanta made some sannyasis, in fact. And now, of course, the other alternative was Babaji's, which is like sannyas, but is beyond the Varnashram system. So that was there because Lord Chaitanya rejected Varnashram as superficial. So therefore, the Vaishnava is beyond all caste designations and Varna designations and ashram designations. So the Babaji is equivalent to a sannyas, but he has no sannyas markings or anything like that. No markings of Varna or ashram. So there is an equivalent in the Babaji type of person that is evolved, even though Lord Chaitanya also doesn't mention that as far as he's concerned. But we do see that the Gosamis himself lived much like that. They didn't take sannyas, but they lived a life of renunciation, lived a simple life, etc., single. So more or less, you can say they were like equivalent to the Babaji also. So that is there. So of course, Lord Chaitanya rejected sannyas because that's external. The whole Varnashram system is, we can say, external in a sense, based upon designations. So the Babaji, of course, tries to get beyond that by going beyond the Varnashram system. But again, of course, that it becomes a designation that one becomes a Babaji or a renounced person. And they may not be renounced, but they just act like a renounced person, live in Radha Kund or something like that, huh? They may or may not be, we don't know. So therefore, we cannot always take the renunciation of a sannyasi or Babaji or whoever as simply their advance because of that. And of course, we have sannyasis or Mayavadis. Also, very renounced, maybe very highly qualified in terms of renunciation and following all the principles of sannyasa mentioned in the Dharma Shastras more than we do. But still, is he spiritually advanced? Not in terms of Vaishnavism, no. Maybe that's in terms of Brahman, but not in terms of the Vaishnav philosophy. So just to say a person is sannyasi is more advanced, it's rather a material way of looking at things. Because it's a material system that doesn't actually, it's indirectly spiritual. It's not directly spiritual. And instead it elevates to Brahma Loka. Of course we see Lord Chaitanya acted within Varna as a Brahman. He didn't act like a Sudra. He acted like a Brahman, followed the rules of a Brahman, etc. And then he also took sannyas. Of course, that was criticized by Nityananda, and he broke his danda and everything. Like that. So, in one sense, he only did that for preaching. Not because of anything else. Simply to get respect from other people, because they respected sannyasis, that's all, rather than grihasthas at that time. So only for that purpose. But as far as supporting Varnashram as such, no. Yeah, he wasn't much interested. Therefore, when Ramananda Roy suggested Varnashram, he rejected it. When the sannyasis in Udupi suggested Varnashram, he rejected it again. So very clearly he rejected that system as the ultimate. Yes, it is. He participated because certain aspects are favorable, but it's not the process we follow. The process we follow is bhakti. That's the main process. No. As far as I know, even Shastra, there is no real initiation for Vanaprastha.
Okay,
that's
it.
How then?
Okay.
Oh, well, they leave their house. They go to the forest. Yeah, yeah. We cannot follow completely that system, really. Vanaprastha or sannyas. So if you look at the system as outlined in the scripture itself, it's rather impossible to follow that system. The vanaprastha, even in the Bhagavatam, you'll see the conduct of the vanaprastha and the sannyas. These are very severe, their conduct. And they live alone, and they live in the forest, and they subsist on the roots and fruits of the forest. They wear bark for clothing and things like this. So it's a very, very austere type of existence. And of course, the idea is to become detached from household life by that austerity. Well, the only thing I said for preaching, that is all. So Bhaktisiddhanta introduced it in the preaching movement. So the sannyasi had more of a leadership, spiritual leadership position, because the sannyasi, as I said, gets more spiritual respect. So then he took the main people and made them into sannyasis, and for that reason, therefore, they, in one sense, in the Western world, no, it doesn't really matter in the West, because they don't even know what a sannyasi is or a brahmachari. Nothing, that doesn't really matter, you know, in terms of Western world, no. In India, yes, we can say it does, but in other countries, probably no. Well, that's their duty. If they take an initiation, then they have to follow. That is their, as a disciple, that is their obligation. The guru's role is to teach and give instruction, and the disciple has to follow that. If he doesn't, then what kind of disciple is he? Therefore, spiritual life will not go on very good. He doesn't follow properly.
How is
going to it won't help at all. It won't help in spiritual life. So how can I be preaching that? Okay? In order to preach properly, one has to have proper spiritual standards. And if one doesn't, then his preaching will also be useless.
But does it depend on the
if he's very sincere, but then again, if he's sincere, he would also follow the instructions and the rules properly. He should.
Is there any
injection
that only sannyasis
initiate? No. Yeah, in fact, the opposite. You look at Chaitanya Charitamrita, it says grihastha should be the initiators, not the sannyasis. And that's generally the system in many sampradayas. Grihasthas initiate. As in Pallava Sampradaya, Sri Sampradaya, mainly it's grihasthas. And even in Lord Chaitanya's Sampradaya, it was all grihasthas up until the Bhaktisiddhanta's time. And of course, Babaji's were also there, but the majority were the caste of Goswamis who were grihasthas. And the reason is, of course, is that the sannyasi should be detached. So it should be detached from disciples too. No, there's grihasthas also. Yeah. Well, it's not forbidden, but as I said in Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's recommended one be a grihastha, because that the sannyasi is wandering around every place, whereas the grihastha isn't. So how can the sannyasi teach the disciple? Because he's never there. Whereas the grihastha sits in one place, so therefore he can teach the disciple who's there. So that's a practical thing.
Well, we can see that, maybe next couple of decades, the system may change in its form.
Could, but we don't know. Could.
And you can guess me that when Lopas can come out the next major global time, now it's less decreasing.
Yeah. Of Of course, total number of sannyasis is more. Well, no, yeah, no, no. But they're only ones.
Now in the Vishwan has made a new rule that Mata is also can become a guru.
Oh.
The guru parampara is
no, there has been gurus. We don't we can say we don't accept those lines, but Srinivasacharya's wives became gurus, Gadadhar's line, I think there's three or four women gurus, Goswaminis. There was Ganga Mata Goswamini in Puri. I don't know what her parampara is, but right after Lord Chaitanya, she was a great, of course, Jana, very famous. She initiated thousands and thousands of people, including her own sons, Virabhadra. And yeah, there are many, many lines where there are women gurus. In fact, most, if you trace most of the lines back of present non-ISKCON and non-Gaudiya Math people, they probably have a few women in their sampradaya. which is Rasikananda's sampradaya, his wife, I think, became a guru. That's Shamananda's line, Rasikananda's there, and then he married, and then his wife, Hemalanda, became a guru, I think, like that. And there's several women in that line. Srinivas line, there's many, Srinivasacharya's line, there's women, his like, two wives became gurus, like that. Gadadhar's line, they became gurus, women became gurus. So it's not uncommon. Of course, because we don't accept the caste Goswamis, but that was most of the Sampradaya, actually, until the present time. We trace two things. Babaji's, who kind of evolved, I think, maybe after 300 years or so, around Vishwanatha Chakravarti's time, but the main lines were family lines. After Lord Chaitanya, that is Advaita Acharya and the pujaris of the temples in Vrindavan, they became Goswamis, like in Gopabhatta's temple, pujaris there, or Madhavan Mohan temple, all these different temples. The pujaris were Bengali Grihasthas, they became the Goswamis, and then their descendants became gurus, like this. So that was the main line. We may not accept that, but that was the main line through those things. And some of them, not all of them, but quite a few of them did have women gurus in them. Who was that? The different sampradaya. Well, we find in the modern day there's so many women gurus. There's some Sindhi woman, I think, who's a guru. There's Anandabai Ma Karela. She's a woman leader. So many women leaders are there. You know, there is in the modern world, anything goes. But as far as Gaudiyas, there are women gurus there. We may not accept those lines, but then which line do we accept then? Ultimately, we only accept a Shiksha line, not a Diksha line at all, because if we do accept a Diksha line, there will be some women in there. Well, up to date, no, they haven't.
But they're giving initiation to women.
They give initiation to women, yes. I don't think they preach even. Preach in the Gaudiya Math, do they? Do they preach at all? Women? Gaudiya Math? I don't think so. I don't think there's any preaching as such. So they don't even have congregational preaching in the Gaudiya Math, as far as I know. So therefore, the only preachers are the brahmacharis in the Math. So ISKCON's a little different in that we do have men and women preaching.
Again, in South India, I met some member Pandit. Their wife is not allowed to do any dating.
Yeah, yes. Many places are like that. Some places aren't. Depends. In the house. Yeah, the women serve the shalagram in the house, so that's there. They cook the food and do all this sort of thing. So it's not a rule. It's an absolute rule. It's not an absolute rule there.
In terms of bhakti, you don't see a man and woman.
Yeah, well, ultimately, that's why we'll find probably that they did have women gurus in our sampradaya compared with you don't find the Sri sampradaya, except Andal, maybe. I don't know if she's a guru or not, but she was a great figure. But in our sampradaya, you do find a prominence, let's say, compared to other sampradayas, some women gurus, even if we could say the caste Goswamis that we don't accept. Still, I think because of this idea that ultimately we're beyond Varnashram, so therefore even a woman could do it. For that reason, I suppose. even though these people were caste Goswamis and they were Brahmins, etc., still they allowed it somehow or other. I think that was their justification.
There's an argument that most of the many communities compared to the male, the better places of the male, they just like to suppress the women. There's an argument. There's been a few people also in the world of women that are like in San Francisco, putting the women's nature very tough.
Yeah.
Causing the women to come up.
Well, that of course is there in the, we see, we can say the male-dominated society. To some degree it's there, and we'll find it in the Smriti Shastras, we'll find that definitely. In the Varnashram system we'll find that. In the Vedas themselves, I don't think there is something like that. And we even find Gargi was an Acharya. There was a woman Acharya. I don't know if there's any more, but at least one famous example is there. Gargi Acharya was a woman, and she learned the Vedas and everything. So somehow it wasn't forbidden, even though it says women should not learn the Vedas. Somehow she learned the Vedas. So it wasn't, didn't seem to be an absolute rule in the Vedic times.
Yeah.
Does she become a man?
Yeah.
And then next lifetime, they're reversing. Yeah. So dangerous for the man. So he has to become detached in household life. That is the message. If he's not detached, then yes, he degrades himself. Yeah, because in one sense, we are not considering Varna and Ashram or anything in terms of Vaishnava. Only the quality of devotion, ultimately, that is what we're considering, not someone's in. So, based on body, we can say that person is born in the Sudra family, therefore he can't be a guru. But we don't say that. If he's a great devotee, then he's a great devotee, and we don't regard his Sudra birth or anything like that. So, the same logic with a woman.
Oh.
Yeah, could be.
And that Brahmas also come from Bhagavatam saying that women, the wife and children are not the father bondage. Considering the wife becomes guru for the dependents, like the guru to have the children and deliver them.
If they can deliver them, fine, yeah, they are guru also. No, because initiation is not based upon the Vedic Gayatri, it's based upon the Vaishnava Gayatris, which every Vaishnava gets, man or woman. That's separate. Vaishnava mantras are separate from the Vedic Gayatri, which is Upanayana. So that's the one that's not given to women, but the other Gayatris and other mantras are given as part of initiation. Vaishnava mantras. In ISKCON, the Brahma Gayatri is also given to women, though Gaudiya Mata, they don't do that. So I don't know what we're doing. What does that mean? Women are superior in the ISKCON to Gaudiya Mata? I don't know. But technically, Gaudiya Mata doesn't give, because it's a little bit funny to give Upanayana to a woman. Because at that ceremony, they actually do an Upanayana ceremony. When they give the Brahma Gayatri, they give do an Upanayana ceremony. It'd be a little strange to see women there sitting for Upanayana. So, of course, the other point is that to some degree we do follow Varnashrama rules. So we follow the rules of cleanliness and social conduct and everything in terms of Varnashrama. Nothing wrong with that, because it helps for sense control, etc. It's not the absolute rule, but these are rules we follow in daily conduct or whatever. So there are, you know, rules of conduct in the family life, and generally follow those rules in our national system, rules of cleanliness for the body, these rules we follow. So interaction of men and women, we follow those rules also, in terms of varnashram. But it's not an absolute rule for us, that's all. So that's why we'll see in the, my explanation anyway, in Gaudiya Sampradaya, even the caste gosangis who are more varnashramic in one sense, they allow women as gurus in their sampradaya.
Also, there's a distinction between the male guru. He has to be born for women, not his guru.
Whatever.
Well, we see that in this also become devotees and sannyasis, even though their parents did not follow the Varnashram Dharma or the Gargal Ashtanga. Because it said that only when you do the Gargal Ashtanga.
Oh, because we're not, as I said, we're not really strictly following the Varnashram system, that's why. We take some of the rules, but we don't follow everything, obviously. If we did, then no one could take the Gayatri Mantra at all. The Brahma Gayatri Mantra, that's the second initiation. We shouldn't have that at all then, in that case. Well, it's not a matter of giving some stars to be a devotee. It's based on a devotee association of past lives, that's all, and Agatha Sukriti's. That's the basis of being a devotee, not samskaras.
Particularly, if the soul is mature in the path of bhakti, it doesn't partake in the conservation of these samskaras.
Well, we see that even in Bhagavatam, it says even the Chandala who chants the name of the Lord is superior to the Brahman. So, he didn't have any samskaras.
Do the Varnashram system was really successful in old eras?
What's that?
Varnashram system.
It's successful in the sense that it stabilized society and there was a king there to enforce it, and they had a workable system for the majority of the people.
But in terms of spiritualization, was it really effective? Because as I said, the people
it's only a step. Along with that, we also have to do the bhakti yoga. If we don't, then it's a failure. As was the case of Prachinavari, who was more absorbed in karma yoga, he wasn't spiritual at all, so he was a failure in that sense. I don't know, he didn't say. Yeah, he allowed women to preach. So they're guru in one sense, and that's it. They are a guru anyway. They preach, they're giving instructions, so in that sense, they're guru.
But on the other hand, they don't know the case that the union should be spread up in every town and place. Both things should be different.
Yeah, so we preach differently to different people. If they don't have faith, then we just give them prasad and let them hear the name. And so, if they have faith, then we preach to them and explain things to them.
Thank you.